What is the color of hunger? Hunger is brown, like a hollow log inside of me. It flows through my body like a raft on a river. It makes me feel empty, like a shell that's been left behind. It makes me want to help others. A poem from a fourth grader living in a suburb of New York City. Hunger doesn't rhyme. The new poor in America. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 28th. Growing legions of middle-class Americans are turning to food pantries for the basics. It's the struggling economy. China, storms are killing people, and there are worries never-ending following the aftermath of the massive earthquake more than 2 weeks ago. In the Great Lakes, are they running out of fresh water? We'll take a look. That and all the news. On the campaign trail, Republican presidential hopeful John McCain appeared with President Bush yesterday. It was the first time in 3 months they were together to raise money. The private event in Phoenix pulled in about $3 million for the Republican National Committee. In a new memoir, former White House spokesman Scott McClellan has strong criticism for his former employer. He says President Bush and his advisors on Iraq, quote, confused the propaganda campaign with the high level of candor and honesty, he says, needed to sustain public support. The Bush administration has not responded publicly to the charge.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak is calling on Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to take a leave of absence or resign as he battles allegations of corruption. The request follows the testimony of an American businessman who says he illegally gave Olmert $110,000 in the past 15 years. Olmert has denied the charges. The National Weather Service says this could be the deadliest tornado season in the U.S. in a decade. With the year only half done, 30 killer tornadoes have already killed 110 people.
Amnesty International released its annual report today. It sharply criticizes the U.S., Russia, and China for failing to tackle human rights abuses. Myla Rosenthal, Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International, says the U.S. should be a moral compass for the world.
One of the first steps that a new president should take is to shut down the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, to either try or release all of the detainees who are being held there.
China is criticized for continuing to ship weapons to Sudan and trading with abusive governments.
Torrential rains that have killed 28 people in southern China are expected to continue for the next 3 days. The stormy weather has only increased fears of flooding in the aftermath of the May 12th earthquake. The death toll now stands at more than 68,000 people. More on China in a moment.
Today, nearly 240 years of royal rule comes to an end in Nepal as a democratically elected assembly is sworn into the new republic. Oil prices fell more than $4 a barrel to $128 yesterday and are holding steady on Asian markets. The Dow opens up 68 at 12,548.
We have a question about adoption today. Cross-racial adoptions. What are the challenges when a child of one race is adopted by parents of another race? It's a subject of a new study, and that's caused a lot of debate, but we're interested in your experiences. Do you or someone close to you have an experience of raising an adopted child of a different race?
We'd like to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Plenty of Washington theater today. Scott McClellan's new book has allegations about the Bush administration and the delegate count. The fate of the Florida and Michigan delegations is going to be decided in a hotel room on Saturday. That'll be more on those stories later on in the show. But two of the main characters, John McCain and Barack Obama, are out west, crisscrossing Nevada, Colorado, and New Mexico this week. Though those states only account for 19 of the 270 electoral votes needed to win the White House, they're likely to be pivotal. The electoral map is beginning to emerge, and here to talk about it is John L. Smith, political columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. John, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Do you see a Western strategy on the part of John McCain and Barack Obama? And if so, what is it and how are they different?
Well, I think as it regards Nevada, they're very different. Barack Obama really, as he has done, you know, throughout most of the United States, he really rolled into Nevada a year or so ago as an almost unknown, and really captured people's imaginations and a lot of the spirit that he's brought to the campaign has occurred here in Nevada as well. McCain, on the other hand, although he's a neighboring senator, he has not had that going for him. He basically in the primary early on didn't campaign here, didn't make a stop here. This was Mitt Romney country during our primary time. So McCain has come out on the opposite side of a couple of controversial issues for Nevadans, the Yucca Mountain issue.
That's the nuclear disposal, the nuclear waste disposal, right?
That's right. And also, he was the sponsor of an unsuccessful but controversial, for Nevadans, again, anti-college sports betting bill. Nevada is a state with legalized college sports betting. So, he's kept a very low profile here. He's come by for some fundraisers and that sort of thing, but he's kept it on the down low. Whereas Barack Obama has really stormed Nevada. He's won the Culinary Union endorsement, which of course is a 60,000 member service workers union here, so we're two very different candidacies thus far.
But you do talk about how Barack Obama came to Nevada with a wow factor, but on the other hand, although McCain hasn't made the same kind of splash, you talk about the kind of connections that he has in Nevada to some very wealthy folks there.
Oh, there's no question in my mind that if the vote were held in the penthouses of the Strip, hotels and resorts, that John McCain would do very well. He has the full endorsement, of course, of the conservative Sheldon Adelson of the Venetian. He has Steve Wynn of Wynn Resorts on his side and Terry Lanny of MGM Grand.
These are all big casinos in Vegas.
Yes, right, big casinos, right. And deep pockets, the ability to generate a lot of donations and that sort of thing. But if you were to talk about that again, that the wow factor, Obama has he's won the street, let's put it that way.
It should be said though, John, that the politicians have actually done very well just focusing on the big shots in states like Nevada and other Western states. Why do you think the populist approach of Barack Obama is likely to be more effective in November, even if it is?
Well, I think partly the economy and some of the reasons that other Americans are fired up about the election this time. I think that there's a strong sentiment in our state that, at least among Democrats, that the direction of the Iraq war is the wrong one. You've seen large increases in Democratic voter registration in our state, where it was basically 1-to-1. Now in Congressional District 3, there is a 20,000 voter advantage to Democrats over Republicans.
Well, John, I want you to listen to a couple of things here, and maybe you can critique the styles of the candidates here. You mentioned the nuclear waste issue in Nevada. Here's John McCain talking in Denver on Tuesday to Western voters about not nuclear waste, but nuclear proliferation. Here's John McCain.
If you look back over the past two decades, I don't think any of us, Republican or Democrat, can take much satisfaction in what we've accomplished to control nuclear proliferation.
McCain in a speech on foreign policy. And here's Barack Obama in Nevada yesterday talking about John McCain.
John McCain is having a different kind of meeting. He's holding a fundraiser with George Bush behind closed doors in Arizona. No cameras, no reporters. And we all know why.
So John Smith, the columnist from the Las Vegas Review-Journal, contrast and compare those two sound bites. It's kind of interesting.
Oh, it is interesting. There's John McCain, the experienced internationalist, and Barack Obama, of course, who's sharpening his stick and poking it through the cage. I mean, we're seeing a candidate who wants to attach McCain to Bush, and I would assume as long as McCain is having fundraisers with Bush, that won't be that hard to do.
Poking it through the cage, that's columnist John L. Smith from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Thank you, John.
Yet another chapter, and we'll be seeing more in the days and weeks to come. We're going to turn to what's happening in China, the latest following the aftermath of the earthquake. 2 weeks ago, almost 160,000 people have reportedly been evacuated below a dam created by that recent quake. It's feared the water backing up could burst through and flood the valley. Meanwhile, in the area hardest hit by the earthquake, grieving parents of children killed in a collapsed school building are throwing traditional caution to the wind and confronting Chinese officials, even starting a petition by some. There's a growing political backlash over shoddy constructions of public schools, and the New York Times' Andrew Jacobs has found himself in the middle. He joins us now from a hospital in Chengdu. And Andrew, how are these outcries, how are they taking shape?
They're sort of informal. I think they started out with parents who've been gathering at the site of these collapsed schools. And they've kind of gained steam in recent days. Yesterday, there was a kind of a bereavement ceremony at one school where as many as 900 children died. And they started out mourning, and then someone grabbed a microphone and, you know, started calling on people to sign a petition, and, you know, anger built, and people, you know, everyone has a story about how they feel the building was, you know, poorly constructed, and then they just, you know, they're just grieving and angry, and they want some accountability.
A lot of emotion, and it sounds like there's been an almost domino effect. You cite several examples in several towns where parents have been confronting, even shouting down officials. In one instance, you talk about how a woman official was screamed at until she fainted.
Yeah, that was over the weekend in the city of Nanju, and these parents who were very, very fearless, let's say, and they screamed at this official, as you said, until she fainted. And the next day, they surrounded another official, and then he begged them to sort of stop their protest, and they continued marching onto Chengdu, and which gathered hundreds of onlookers or supporters. And so the scene got pretty chaotic at one point when the police started to trying to stop them, and there was a clash, and some of the pictures they're carrying of their children broke, and people were cut, and it was pretty pretty heartrending. And eventually, the police and the officials persuaded their parents to get on a bus, so they wouldn't have to walk 40 miles. And they took them to another city to meet with some officials.
Now, authorities in Beijing, you say they appear to be recognizing the delicacy of the issue, saying that they have launched investigations into the constructions of those schools and saying that they plan to severely punish anyone responsible for some of that construction. How is that going over?
I think there's I don't think it's really been presented in an official way that parents can appreciate. I think they feel like what they're getting so far, at least in the local level, is they feel like they're getting lip service. They haven't seen any sign of an investigation. So I think, at least at this point, it hasn't really, they're not really satisfied, we'll say. I think it just going to depend on how aggressive the government does these investigations and how public they are. So that kind of remains to be seen.
And obviously this is all happening at a time when it's still raining in some of the endangered areas. And there are still, according to Chinese officials, somewhere around 20,000 people who are trapped under the rubble, perhaps some survivors, although it's hard to see at this point.
Yeah, I think that's unlikely, but the issue of these dams, it seems to be pretty severe, and the government has been very expressing urgency that some of them could burst. These are not man-made dams, but avalanches that sort of
created from the earthquake. Andrew Jacobs, reporting for the New York Times from Chengdu. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Adoption across racial lines, as you know, John, often spurs intense debate. Since 1996, the law says race should not be a part of the consideration in placing children. But a new report takes issue with that colorblind policy. The Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute, a nonprofit that studies and provides education on adoption, argues that race should be a factor in adoption placement, including preparing white families for what they may face. We turn now to two people who have experience with transracial adoption, Judith Stigger, Director of International Adoption, Cradle Adoption Agency, and her son, Aaron Stigger. Judith, you and your husband are white, and you adopted your son and daughter, both biracial, back in the 70s, long before colorblind adoption was mandated. Do you think you were prepared for raising children of color?
I don't think the topic was particularly discussed. It was discussed in terms of the absence of prejudice. It wasn't discussed in terms of the kinds of resources you might want to help to equip your child to grow up in the world.
And how did your family and friends react when you and your husband made this decision? And what issues did you think you would face with your family, with your children? And what have you faced?
Well, that's a very complicated question. The families and friends were supportive, with the exception of one grandmother who found this a little bit embarrassing because of the area she lives in. But basically everyone else was excited for us that we finally had kids and not particularly concerned about the issue of race one way or the other. I knew we would face the bigger global issues. I knew there were communities we would now not live in because our children would be oddities in those communities. I knew it would affect where we would send them to school and that sort of thing. I expected some comments of prejudice from strangers occasionally. What I didn't get was a little day-to-day stuff, that, you know, something would happen if you're not sure it's prejudice or if it's just that person was having a bad day. And I didn't get the question of the omission of images, not that we weren't prejudiced, but that we were now a multiracial family and that was a new identity with all kinds of possibilities and challenges tied to it.
And, Aaron, you talk about growing up, how you had various feelings and thoughts about race. Do you want to share a couple of those stories with us, for example, when you were in sixth grade?
Well, a lot of the issues that I had with race was just explaining the fact that if I had a new friend who would come over and they'd see my mom, who's white, they'd just kind of assume and say, oh, your dad must be black. And my birth father's black, so that's not technically a lie. But once dad would stroll through the doors, then I kind of had to explain it. Then they said, oh, okay, and then we went and played with our G.I. Joes. But, you know, that was kind of an awkward moment with bringing new friends into the house.
And your G.I. Joes were white, right?
Oh, all of them.
Yeah, so you were twisted from every end there.
There was one. He was a roadrunner. That was a brother. But the rest of them were pretty non-diversified.
And you also talk about how, and this is really interesting because, Judith, then I'm going to bring you into this, but Aaron, you talked about how you could remember times walking around with your family in certain places and feeling people staring at you, and so it made you uncomfortable. And, Judith, you say you didn't necessarily notice it as much as Aaron did. Aaron, let's start with what your recollection is.
Yeah, I can't even confirm that I noticed it, but I definitely felt it. It could have just been an internalized feeling. There was a time in junior high when I was with one of my friends who was black and his mom who was black. And I felt a sense of comfort as if I wasn't the sore thumb in the mall. I mean, it's not cool to be in the mall with your mom anyway, but
you
got to be there. She might as well look like you. But in the same sense, is when I'm out with my mom as a kid, and she's white, well, there's still a good chance that my father's at home and he's black.
We should tell people, but you grew up in suburban Chicago. You're in Oak Park, Illinois right now, right, Judy?
Correct.
Yeah, we've always lived in Oak Park, which is a diversified community, and we had chosen to live here as a matter of who we are before we adopted.
And Aaron, do you think, in taking a look at what this study is saying, do you think it would have been helpful or should be helpful for white families adopting children of color to have some kind of preparation, to have that discussed before they adopt?
I think it should be talked about, but not into the extreme of where you're taking kind of a two-year master's program. It's something that you have to be aware of, and a few pointers that they can give you. But I don't think it's that elaborate, not enough to discourage anybody from doing it.
Judy Stigger, director of International Adoption, Cradle Adoption Agency, and her son Aaron Stigger, an actor in Los Angeles. Thanks to you both.
Those guys are pioneers.
They are pioneers.
Back in the 70s, very very different time.
Now we have more headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Hello there. Coming up at 26 minutes past the hour, President Bush is in Utah today to raise more money for John McCain after yesterday's effort, which raised $3 million. In Nepal, the king has 15 days to leave the palace. A newly elected government is prepared to become the world's newest republic. In Israel, Ehud Barak is asking Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to step down while he's being investigated for corruption. And apparently the International Space Station has a plumbing problem. The lone lavatory is broken, so NASA may have to include a plumbing service call to the list of space shuttle discovery tasks for next week.
Well, they can just go outside, right?
They could. In space, nobody can hear you. A bloot.
I'm not going there.
Do you mind if I go back to the story we were just doing on the takeaway?
The adoption.
With Judy and Aaron Stigger. Because when I was 6 weeks old, I was fostered by a British white family. So my mum and dad and my family is completely white. And I really identified with Aaron talking about his G.I. Joes being all white. I had Barbie dolls. And then occasionally I'd be bought a brown doll. And I put the brown doll right at the back of the playpen. And I remember as a little kid just wanting to be the same colour as my parents. And I liked walking in the dark, because in the dark nobody could see that I was a little brown girl, not a little white girl. So it really does have an impact on youngsters' psyche as they grow up if they're in a family where they're not the same color as their parents.
You wouldn't have done any differently, though, would you?
I have one of the most amazing experiences. I have a British culture, but I also have an African Nigerian culture, and there's no way I would have been able to see both sides of that other than having this unusual background and unusual childhood.
So what's your thought on what should be discussed with families who are going to adopt a child of a different race?
I think they should be part of a community where there are people and families, or maybe aunts and uncles or an extended family where they have black or whatever their race is, so that they have role models so they can see themselves in other people close to them. And for instance, my hair was just dreadful for 7 years. My Afro hair in the 60s and the 70s, being looked after by British parents, they had no clue what to do with my hair. And I looked appalling.
Hair is such a symbol of so many things,
and
isn't it?
And skin and moisturizing, which is all very much part of the African-American culture.
It's interesting what you're saying. There's no reason to be a pioneer anymore. You can find a community where there are role models.
Find someone
really
to help you.
Because
it's more important that kids get great homes than black or white homes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We want you to join our conversation. You can at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Our discussion of adoption and transracial adoptions already drew a response from our own Femi Okeh. You can weigh in as well. We also got a response from Steve, who said, for a program that brags about being immediate and in the moment, you guys missed this morning's big story, former White House spokesman Scott McClellan's memoir about his time in the White House. Actually, Steve will have more on that in just a moment. But now to geography. 20% of the world's fresh water is in the five Great Lakes of North America, and the lakes are what's left over from a giant glacial melt at the end of the last ice age, which is why the water isn't salty, and why it's a lucky break for North America, and why it's also an enticing solution to water problems outside the Midwest. The lakes are a geographic marvel. They drain half a continent, but they're also at the intersection of all kinds of water flow. Water in some places around the Great Lakes flows into the lakes, while other drainage just a few miles or even yards away flows elsewhere into the Mississippi. For that reason, the eight governors of the Great Lakes states and two Canadian provinces want to protect their water resource from being pumped to places south and west, experiencing some of the worst drought since the Dust Bowl. It's all having some very strange consequences in some communities around the Great Lakes. Towns that may be near the lakes may not have access to their abundant fresh water at all. Take the town of Waukesha, Wisconsin. Waukesha Mayor Larry Nelson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So you got a problem with your wells, right? And you can't use Lake Michigan as a backup. Explain.
Well, we're 5 miles west of the groundwater divide. And so right now our water goes to the Mississippi River, not to the Great Lakes. So in order to get access to Great Lakes water that it does not have any radium, we would need to apply for a diversion. And under the 1985 water law, there's no real standards or accepted procedure for doing that. But under the Great Lakes Compact, which the state of Wisconsin was signed into law yesterday, we have a fair opportunity to do that.
Well, Larry, first of all, you have radium in your wells, which is not good at all, so you do need to get some fresh water. And the compact, even though it allows for you to possibly get access to the Great Lakes water, it basically establishes the principle, and these eight states and Canadian provinces are in the process of ratifying this, it establishes the principle that the Great Lakes water stays in the Great Lakes. If they let you have it, then maybe down in Florida they may want to pump a pipeline or a canal to Georgia or somewhere to irrigate farms down there. Is that the principle?
No, because in order to be eligible to apply, you have to be in a straddling county, which means you have to be in a county next to the groundwater divide where people do have access to the water. So the only reason
you get the exception is because you're really close to this groundwater divide.
Exactly.
Georgia doesn't get a shot at your water, right?
Exactly. That's correct.
Why do you think the governors have such a concern about protecting the water of the Great Lakes from the rest of the nation?
Well, I think the priority is to protect the Great Lakes for not only today's generation but future generations, and to come up with a fair and equitable way for a city like Waukesha that is really right there to be able to apply. But we're researching doing return flow to a tributary of Lake Michigan so that any water that we would receive would really be recycled and be going back to the lake, so we wouldn't have any kind of negative impact on Lake Michigan at all.
So, Mayor, that in your mind would be a fair and equitable result in resolving these conflicting issues?
Yes, there's very strict requirements for a successful application. You have to be doing water conservation, which our city a number of years ago has passed a comprehensive water conservation plan, which includes a total daytime sprinkling ban. We're the first city in the state of Wisconsin that got our Public Service Commission to allow us to charge our heaviest water users more than the typical charge, which is less. And we're also researching this return flow. So if we do a successful application, we're hoping to be a role model for anybody who's in a straddling county.
So you want to set a precedent for conservation techniques as a way of getting access to the water. One final question. Radium in your groundwater, does that mean your toilet's like glow in the dark?
No, this is a mandate from the Environmental Protection Agency. We actually did an independent study that showed we didn't have any higher rates of illness, but we fought the standard, but we lost that fight.
Yeah, but nobody likes radium in their water, that is for sure. But Larry, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Larry Nelson is the mayor of Waukesha, Wisconsin, there with radium in his water.
And as always, we are reading your emails on the many lines of conversation or threads of conversation that we continue to have both on air and online. And talking about the beauty premium, which is something we've discussed this week, whether or not some people benefit from the way they look in their careers or how tall they are. Pete Hill in Manhattan wrote to the Takeaway website saying, "You seem to have taken Michael Bloomberg as a counterexample to the theory of correlations between height, attractiveness, and earnings potential. It's worth pointing out that Bloomberg is not exactly a 9-to-5 wage drone who labors at the mercy of bosses and their subconscious prejudices." Good point. Billionaires as a group tend to be entrepreneurial. Perhaps it's the case that the short guys and talented but aesthetically challenged individuals have even more incentive to drop out of the rat race and take risks that sometimes pay off in big ways. There's a thought.
Worked for Bloomberg.
Now time for headlines with Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there. 21 minutes to the hour. I've just been doing some phone bashing on the phone, talking to South Africa. The South African government is unveiling plans to set up special refugee camps to house up to 70,000 migrant workers. So for the last 2.5 weeks, and we've been talking about this on the Takeaway, angry groups of South Africans have been targeting foreigners. Here's one Mozambique's refugee story.
It's as close to a war as you can get. I've left a lot behind and brought very little with me, but at least I've got my soul. As for the future, I'm not sure. I don't have any money, and I'm counting on the Mozambican government to help me. The government has been asking us to keep calm, and we shouldn't retaliate, and for the time being, we should go back to our families.
Early on this morning, I spoke to the BBC's Caroline Hawley, who was reporting from the township of Alexandria. She said the government were really under the gun in terms of doing something very quickly. They're going to create these camps. But it sounds very strange to put a whole load of strangers and foreigners in a camp. And if you rewind back to 1994, it sounds very peculiar, almost like a little bit like apartheid in a country that really fought and is known as the Rainbow Nation.
And these are worker camps. They're basically workers who have to go back and forth into the cities to actually
for
their jobs. And they need protection on the way and where they get home.
And I have to say the majority of South Africans are in uproar about this. They're ashamed, they're embarrassed to be seen in this way. But it is a real vein that's running through some parts of South Africa in terms of being angry and frustrated and kicking back.
Is this a way they believe that they can contain violence, prevent violence?
Well, protecting people, basically.
But the economic forces, the destabilizing economic forces, that doesn't deal with that at all. They're going to continue.
Yeah, and it doesn't fix the unemployment. It goes on.
Thank you, Femi.
Which is somewhere near 30%, I believe, in South Africa.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. As we noted at the top of the show, this is a morning of some dramatic political theater in Washington on a couple of fronts. The fate of the delegations in Florida and Michigan to the Democratic National Convention may be decided, well, assuredly will be decided on Saturday in a very arcane committee meeting at a hotel in Washington. More about that in a moment. But everyone is talking in Washington about Scott McClellan's new book, which was supposed to be embargoed until Monday. It'll be released on Monday. But the book from Scott McClellan talks all about allegations that the Bush administration used propaganda instead of candor to sell the war in Iraq. There's a discussion of conversations with the president about alleged drug use, the Valerie Plame affair. All in all, not a good moment for Condoleezza Rice in this book. The Politico's chief political correspondent, Mike Allen, was the first person to report about the book. Here's what he said this morning on CNN.
These aren't particularly novel observations, but who knew that they would be coming from Scott? And that's the power of them, is that they come from someone. There was no one who was closer to the president. He's taken closer personally, as you know, was one of the first to come with the president from Texas, was with him since 99, traveled with the president on the campaign plane in 2000. Now Scott's put on a new hat. He's put on historian's hat.
Because he was then governor Bush. He was his spokesperson, and for an administration that we've noted many times that has been incredibly disciplined in keeping all of the people, all of their people in order, and for there being very few leaks coming out of that administration, that's what makes this even more surprising.
Well, the closed circle is gone. I don't know if I kind of wish Scott McClellan would have given us a little bit of a heads up on the propaganda before we got into the war, but then I guess that's not his job. They were being the loyal Bush inside circle back then, but it seems a little disingenuous to put it into a memoir. But on the other story...
is it disingenuous?
I can't. It drives me crazy, but I know you disagree with me, but it totally drives me crazy. I want to take him out back.
Because you wanted McClellan, him to make all of these announcements the time?
What else do you do in government? Tell the truth to the people. And if you're the spokesman every day, why wouldn't you do it then? I don't know. But before I get into a whole thing... This weekend's meeting of the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee is going to decide the fate of the Florida and Michigan delegations. Earlier, we talked with blogger and superdelegate Ed Espinoza, and he laid out just how strange and interesting this meeting that the whole world will be watching on Saturday in Washington, D.C. is going to be.
What you should expect to see is you've got a committee of about 35, 40 people. And you'll have a room of observers, and then you'll have some folks coming in to make their presentations. You'll have a presentation made by each presidential campaign. But more importantly, you'll have one made by each state delegation, one from Michigan and one from Florida, talking about why they think that their delegation should be seated in full.
I think we should point out that among the committee members, some of them are Clinton loyalists, right, and some of them are Barack Obama loyalists. And there is some notion that it will be public. It's just not clear.
Well, it has to be public.
Right, but there is some whether or not the public is going to be able to ask questions.
Apparently,
it
public
hasn't
can't
been
ask
laid
questions.
Out.
Public can't ask questions. They
cannot.
They can sit there. The whole thing is open, but it's not clear if the deliberations in the afternoon are going to be open. So this is a very, very interesting glimpse into the inner workings of the Democratic National Committee.
And there's that report today saying that at least half must be discounted between the two states. So
lots
we'll
to
see.
Discuss. Stay tuned for Saturday.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 28th, and we have some headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Hello there. At 12 minutes to the hour, the durable goods orders for April are in, and demands for big ticket items fell by a smaller than anticipated amount, just 0.5%. Whether or not this year sets a record for tornadoes, the one so far has been stronger and deadlier. 110 people have died this year, and more than 20 tornadoes have been at the top end of the rating scale. Talks between United Airlines and US Airways appear to have fallen apart. It's the second time in a month that United has failed to reach a deal with a rival airline. A Democratic Party analysis says Michigan and Florida must lose at least half their convention delegates for holding their primaries too early. Senator Hillary Clinton has pressed to fully seat them. And finally, the much-anticipated Sex and the City movie opened in New York last night. Or I should say, the world premiere was last night.
I always knew she'd marry big.
You thought that after the second breakup?
Yep.
After the 15th?
Uh-huh. We broke up a lot.
But real life?
200 people?
But don't you want...
I want you. That's what I want.
You haven't seen those ladies for the last 4 years. Well, unless you've been watching the reruns. The movie opens on May the 30th, but we're going to bring you a little review right now. Adora was on the red carpet last night. Adora.
I was, sort of. It was actually pink.
You're in the movie?
It was a pink carpet at the premiere for Sex and the City.
Oh, you got to go to the premiere? Yeah.
I'll do an Adora here. You've got 20 seconds. Give us a review.
It was a fun movie, lots of great clothes, some interesting issues that young women living in the city deal with, and they caught you up with what's been happening with those four women in the last 4 years.
That was more than six words.
She didn't say six
so
words.
So we got to go. We've got to move
20
on.
Seconds.
We have to move on to the next segment.
We are moving on. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Ooh, here's a segue.
I know. This is a tough one. But it's obviously something we've been talking about for weeks now, and that's the economic news that's been rolling out. And for some people, it's very tough times, and we've seen the numbers. And now we're taking a look at how those numbers are being reflected in everyday life. A rising number of Americans are turning to food assistance, to food stamps and pantries. America's Second Harvest, a network of 200 food banks across the country, report an increase in demand of 20% over last year. The numbers are climbing, especially for those who considered themselves solidly in the middle class. Families like that of Janie Larson in a suburb of Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, Janie.
Thanks.
Now you're a
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for being with us. You're a grandmother of two. You work full-time, but yet this week you found yourself somewhere for the very first time in your life, and where was that?
Well, I was finding myself, you know, getting donations for food and not being able to purchase food because I had to worry about, you know, gas and parking at work to get there.
And what put you, was that what put you over the edge? Because as we said, you work full time, you work in the juvenile correctional system, and but it's not enough. Was it just the gas prices?
No, I was. I found myself unemployed at an older age, and of course, my resume reflected my age by, you know, my work experience. I could not even get an interview, and luckily, I landed the job with the county. However, it doesn't, you know, pay a whole lot to substantiate two children and the gas, and the food prices are outrageous.
How did it make you feel, Janie?
I'm terrified. I don't sleep at night. I'm scared for my grandkids. I mean, I just, you know, what are we looking at? And I'm not going to be the only one in this situation, I understand. And I feel sorry for the ones who are worse off than I, but it's terrifying.
And you're right. You're not the only one. We're going to turn now to Amy Lipp. She's a 31-year-old mother of three. She lives in California in a community between L.A. and San Diego. And 2 years ago, you and your husband, Amy, were making almost $100,000 a year. You were feeling very comfortable. But your husband's been out of work for since August. And now you, too, find yourself in a situation that you've never been in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning. My heart goes out to Janie because I know where she's at right now, and we never thought we'd be in this situation ever, and it's just been a surreal experience.
And and what was it for you? What was the cost of life that put you over the edge where you had to seek food stamps?
My husband, since he's been unemployed since August, we exhausted our savings. We cashed out our 401k just to survive. Then his unemployment ran out, and he's been unable to find work. And so it came to the point where we couldn't pay our electric bill and feed our kids. And so my sister said, "You need to go check out food stamps because you can't do this." The stress was just eating away at us of not being able to provide for our children.
Now, when you get food stamps, does it alleviate that concern? I mean, Janie is talking about being terrified, even though she's found some support. I'm wondering if that's the same feeling that you're having.
You know, it's amazing what it did to alleviate that burden, because we're terrified about everything else, about losing our home, about losing our cars, losing everything that we've worked so hard for the last several years, or, you know, since we've been married. We're constantly terrified. But knowing that we can feed our kids has alleviated a huge burden for us, because we've always provided very well for them, and that there's nothing that makes you feel more like a failure than not being thinking you can't feed your children.
Janie, who did you think the poor were before you had this experience, and who do you think the poor are now?
The poor were the people that, you know, were uneducated and just, you know, had lost. Never really came from anything. I mean, I had so much empathy. I used to give to the poor and help and, you know, donate and do everything I can. I've lost my house. I filed bankruptcy. I make $12.49 an hour. I don't even qualify for food stamps. And yet, you know, if I get something that, you know, I know I'm not going to use, I will redonate it to the pantry. Just, you know, because I'm a giver. I'm not a taker. And I found myself in a totally different, you know, at my age, in a totally different way of life.
Did that make it difficult to make that step to ask for help, Janie?
It did. It did, and people at work were trying to help me, you know, and I was like, I just closed my eyes and say, just take it, you know, just, you know, they would give me food or, you know, clothing for the kids or things like that. But, you know, I can't afford.
Amy, what advice do you have for people who are coming up to the edge, running the numbers and are maybe hesitating to reach out?
You know, there's a shame and a stigma attached, I think, to people like us who have always worked hard and, you know, not to lessen that people who have always struggled, but, I think it's harder for us to reach out because we've always been the ones who have helped others and done things like that. So I would say that's why there are programs out there. That's what we've had to tell ourselves. That's why this food stamps program was designed, for people who are in need. And unfortunately, we're in a need situation, so you need to reach out and take what's out there for you.
Amy, I don't think you'd be surprised to know that actually the government reports that more than 1.5 million more people this year are using food stamps than a year ago.
That's an amazing number.
So
that doesn't shock me at all. And the way you're treated, I mean, it's like they've done studies on heavy people and skinny people getting jobs and how they're treated and, become poor.
What do you tell your kids?
So much, you know.
What do you tell your kids? What do you explain to your kids, your grandkids in your case, Janie, and your kids, Amy, about this sort of experience?
With my kids, they went with us for one of the food stamps meetings. We had to go in and meet with the people at the food stamps office, and we did talk to them about it because I didn't want them to think something was wrong, but they could tell we were upset. Because it was hard, and we just said that there are people that are going to help us because Mommy and Papa are having a hard time, and these people are going to help us so that you have some good, healthy food to eat. And, you know, we just tried to make it – we don't want them to feel the brunt of this. And
how old are they?
Going to. I have a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 4-year-old.
And, Janie, how old are your grandkids?
They just turned 4 and 5, and so I really have not shared with them the hardship. We're looking to move because, like I said, my house is being foreclosed on. And I think that would scare them because they were with my son and his wife who were addicts, and they were shifted from motel to places. And this is the first security they've had for a year, and now I have to disrupt that. And I'm going to have to explain to them. I've tried to buffer it with telling them how exciting it's going to be, and I don't know. But I'm terrified myself. So.
We can definitely feel those challenges that you have. Gosh, thanks so much for speaking to us and for helping
sharing.
All the people out there who are facing some of the similar kinds of decisions.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for drawing attention to this.
Sure. Well, we'll be back to talk to you again. And good luck to both of you. Janie Larson from Columbus, Ohio, and Amy Lips from Lake Elsinore, California.
Thank you so much.
Good luck, Amy.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Wow. James Andino wrote to us about that interview. He said, I listened to your show about Janie, the grandmother of two, and was very moved by it. I totally understand what she's feeling. I would like to send her a check for $100 so that she could buy the kids a little something. I know it's not much, but I want to do something for her and the kids. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. Adoption is colorblind by law. Some say it shouldn't be. We want your stories and responses. Also, we're following this Saturday's Democratic Party intrigue and much more.
At The Takeaway, call or email us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,